So good evening. My name is Jigme, and I'll be doing the final review of the text, Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun, that Venerable Children just finished teaching on. So let's first begin by setting our motivation. So let's feel gratitude and appreciation for our opportunity that we have, especially having a human body and human intelligence. And we can study and understand the Dharma. And we have some interest in the path. And that we really have some willingness to explore. And once we start doing that, we see that it's quite complex. And even so, we persist. Even when the teachings don't make sense to us immediately. And even when we don't experience immediate benefit. Day by day and week by week, generating bodhicitta, thinking about the nature of reality as best that we can. And then really sustained by our bodhicitta motivation to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all. And we slowly, slowly, bit by bit, progress along the path. Until one day we do achieve Buddhahood. And even though sometimes that seems almost impossible, we remind ourselves that by the force of causes and effect, if we create the cause, the effect will come. And so we just continually create the causes. And we do this for the benefit of all. And so let's set that firm motivation tonight as we share the Dharma. So Venerable Children taught for 18 weeks on the topic of ultimate bodhicitta. So needless to say, it's impossible to even do a cursory review of that many weeks of teaching in an hour, even in a subject that's quite simple, much less one that's so complex like emptiness. So what I'm going to do is review a little bit about how we prepare the mind before studying, and then some about recognizing what ignorance is and the problems of leaning toward nihilism and or absolutism, and a little bit on the importance of discriminating what is the definitive and interpretable meaning of emptiness. And then I'm going to review a teaching that Alec Berzin gave some years back that I came across that uses the Indian tenet systems as a graded path for meditation. And what he taught is kind of a nice overview, I think, that can bring a framework around all of Venerable's very deep teachings that we received. So let's start with Venerable's teaching on preparing the mind. So she stressed that it's really important to begin with understanding the method side of the path. so getting an understanding of conventional reality, how cause and effect work before embarking on the study of ultimate bodhicitta. And if one studies in this manner, then there will be less chance of falling into nihilism, because one has already studied cause and effect and the conventional existence. And also by practicing the method side of the path, we've done purification and accumulated some merit. So when meditating on emptiness, then the mind is more stable and not so inclined to misinterpret the teachings. And so also in the thought training practices, we deeply contemplate the four fundamental topics of the preliminary practices. So precious human life and death and impermanence, karma and its effects, and the miseries of cyclic existence. And then in the actual practice, we become well acquainted with the awakening mind and its attributes, and we seek the meaning of enlightenment in the interest of others. So we don't do it for ourselves. So next, Venerable talked about recognizing what ignorance is. And in the text, Nam Kapel writes, "Ignorance, or a lack of basic awareness, is diametrically opposed to awareness. It is not merely other than awareness, nor is it the mere negation of awareness. It is the opposing factor that directly counteracts awareness. This awareness of self should not be understood as just any sort of awareness, but as discriminating intelligence, discriminating wisdom that cognizes the meaning of selflessness. So that being the case, ignorance is that which exaggerates phenomena, conceiving of them as being self-existent. So this awareness is the wisdom that understands reality." And she really stressed that ignorance isn't just the opposite of it. It's not just a not knowing, but it's a mind that grasps precisely the opposite of what wisdom grasps. It is actually grasping things to exist in the exact opposite way from the way they exist. So whereas things arise dependently and are empty of true existence, ignorance grasps them as truly existent. So it's not just that ignorance is some kind of fog, but it's an active process. It actively grasps them in the wrong way. So then we have to see, how do things exist? And how does ignorance grasp the opposite way? Ignorance doesn't directly perceive things as inherently existent, because there are no inherently existent things that you can directly perceive. So it's conceptual in that it's a thought consciousness, and it's perceiving things through a conceptual appearance. Now, in our Western life, when we hear and think about concepts, it's kind of a very gross kind of concept. We think that, you know, I'm sitting here thinking in words, or that there's a concept out there. But when we're talking about concept here, we're not talking about this gross kind of thinking concept that we use. It's a very, very subtle kind of concept. And that's why Venerable says that grasping is a much better word to use. The word grasp is more illustrative at what we're actually doing. So I'm grasping at inherent existence. I'm holding on tight. Whereas if I just say I'm conceiving it as true existence, that doesn't have the same force or intensity, I think. It's not descriptive enough. So by beginning to understand the depth of our ignorance, we can see how important it is to identify this deeply held conceptual appearance. So when we're meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence, it's very important to identify what the object of negation is. If we don't negate enough, then some of the grasping at true existence is going to be there. If we go overboard and negate too much, then we're going to have a nihilistic view. And so that's when we then get into the two extremes of absolutism or nihilism. The nihilistic view holds the phenomena do not exist, or even if they do exist, causality does not exist. So instead of meditating on things being empty of true existence, a person with this view meditates things being non-existent. Now, I think for us, because of our education in science, we have a understanding of things existing even when we can't see them. So I don't think we'll be so inclined to misinterpret and think things are non-existent. But if you don't negate enough, it's absolutist, because there are still remnants of an absolute independent self that you're hanging on to. And I think this is more what we're prone to. So if you negate too much, you then fall into nihilism and you can't establish conventional existence. And this is very dangerous, because then you don't think about cause and effect. And then ethical discipline is lost, and then you end up creating a lot of negative karma. And so this whole discussion about avoiding the two extremes, this is the meaning of the middle way. When Nagarjuna talks about the middle way, this is what he's talking about philosophically, between these two positions is the middle way. And so as soon as we begin studying emptiness teachings, the topic of discriminating what is the definitive and interpretable meaning of emptiness arises. Philosophical assertions of all Buddhist systems and scholars were taught by the Buddha. They're very different. The Buddha, being a very skillful teacher, knew that not everybody was appropriate to receive the same teachings. So he gave different teachings to different people according to their level of understanding and their disposition. And so the four philosophical systems all have different views of selflessness. And the Buddha turned the wheel of Dharma three times. The first turning of the Dharma wheel included a collection of sutras where the Buddha spoke about the Four Noble Truths. The second turning of the Dharma wheel was a group of sutras that talked about emptiness. Then the third turning of the Dharma wheel included the sutras that have two threads in them. One is the sutras that became the Chittamatran doctrine, and also there are the sutras that teach about Buddha nature. And so why do we talk about this subject of definitive and interpretable? It's because we want to follow the definitive teachings. And what are they? Well, they have to be talking about the actual way in which things exist in a mode that can't be understood in any other kind of manner. Whereas the interpretable teachings are needed because this is where all the teachings about dependent arising come from. The interpretable teachings talk about conventionalities. So they talk about impermanence, the 12 links, bodhicitta, and of course are very important. But they're just not talking about the ultimate mode of existence. And so we can see why Venerable stresses the importance of precisely identifying if you are investigating conventional or ultimate analysis when you are describing anything. She says, for example, from the Prasangika point of view, teaching on the self-sufficient, substantially existent person would be provisional, because they are not the deepest mode of existence. But negating those are very useful for approaching and understanding the Prasangika view. If we're holding on to there being a permanent, partless, independent person, there's no way we're going to be able to realize emptiness. That has to be the first concept to go. And for many of us, that's the concept we were raised in a religion that believes in the existence of a creator God. So we really have to meditate on what is really possible to exist and what isn't. We need to approach them in a very open-minded way. And so one way to meditate to get clear understanding of how things exist is by using the Indian tenet system as a method to deepen our understanding of how things actually exist. So now I'll move into the teachings that Alex Berzin gave. When I first heard this teaching, I didn't really understand it. It's interesting that I came across it not so long ago in my notes, and then when I reread it, I had some glimmers of understanding it, and that's due to Venerable Chödrön's depth of her teaching in this text for all these weeks. So the Tibetan masters have taught the Indian tenet system as graded steps in meditation, which are then applied to daily life. And their purpose is to help us go deeper in our understanding of the true nature of reality. So two of these tenet systems, the Vibhashika and Sautrantika, were subdivisions within the fundamental vehicle. And the other two, Chittamatra and Madhyamaka, subdivisions within Mahayana. Within the Madhyamaka, there's two subdivisions also, Svatrantika and Prasangika. So we use the understandings of the tenet systems to gradually narrow in on the most sophisticated explanation. And the example Alex used was like when first learning Newtonian physics. We then refine that understanding with Einstein's theory of relativity, and then further refined it with superstring theory. So each theory is relatively true and functional, and they differ merely in accuracy. So Alex stressed that it's important to try and understand each set of tenet systems one at a time, and to try to see reality through each of their views. And by practicing seeing reality through these views, then, I think that's where we get clear about what we are negating, which is so important. He also says it's not wise to throw out the lower systems. And he says, after all, Buddha gave the general principles for each of them, and then the great Indian masters elaborated their details. So each of them have very valid sources, and they were all intended to help people overcome suffering. He also stressed that it's important to proceed through the theories in the proper order, without skipping any. He said that the result of skipping the less sophisticated systems and jumping immediately to the more profound ones usually renders the more profound theories trivial. So the method for going deeper in our understanding comes from Shantideva. He wrote that a debate is possible only when the two proponents accept an example in common, such as all things being like an illusion, and both accept as well the conventional functioning of cause and effect, despite all things being like an illusion. So this is true in meditation as well, as we try to gain ever deeper understandings. So this is the example we'll use, all things being like an illusion. So the point of the analogy of things being like an illusion is that an illusion appears to be real, but does not actually exist in the manner in which it appears to exist. And often the example is used of a striped rope, which can be mistaken in low light as a snake. A striped rope may be the basis for the illusion that it exists as a snake. The rope appears to exist as a snake, but it does not actually exist in that way. Nevertheless, the basis for the illusion, namely the rope appearing deceptively to be a snake, functions to scare us. You cannot say that what the illusion seems to be, the snake itself, scares us. because the snake does not exist. Although the appearance of what resembles a snake occurs and therefore exists, the illusion is the appearance of the snake arising on the basis of the rope. The rope itself is not the illusion. The rope, as it appears to a deceived mind, is merely like an illusion. So the basis for the illusion and the appearance of the illusion both exist and both function. What the illusion appears to be does not exist and does not function. So the same analysis applies, for example, to a difficult situation in life that appears to exist like a problem that cannot be solved. The difficult situation can cause us to, for example, lose our job. But its appearance of existing as an unsolvable problem is like an illusion. The difficult situation and its appearance as an unsolvable problem exist, but unsolvable problems do not exist. There is always some solution for a difficult situation, even though it might not be the ideal one. But there's always an option. So to work with the example of things being like an illusion, we need to recognize something in our everyday lives that in some way is like an illusion and yet which functions. We need to find an example. Once we can recognize and readily accept this personal example, then we can deepen our understanding of what the illusion is. And how do we deepen our understanding? We learn a new definition and then see how that works. If it works better, we may be convinced to accept the new definition. And once accepting the new definition, we then have deepened our understanding. So we can use the understandings of the Indian tenet systems as a method to deepen our understanding of the true nature of reality. We can apply the example of things existing like an illusion both to individual beings and to phenomena in general. So Alex began with the investigating the lack of an impossible soul of a person. So all Buddhist tenet systems accept the conventional existence of a self, me. The conventional me, however, seems to exist in a way that does not match up with how it actually exists. The conventional me seems to exist in the manner of an impossible soul or Atman. The self that exists in this false way is known as the false me, the me that is to be refuted. So the conventional me is like an illusion and it exists. The appearance of a false me is the illusion and it exists. What would correspond to the illusion, an actual false me, does not exist. So if we've been taught and we believe one of the non-Buddhist Indian tenet systems, we would experience grasping for a false me that is based on this doctrine. Like an illusion, the conventional self would appear to us as a soul, having a true identity as an unaffected or permanent, solid entity that exists separately from the body and mind or the four aggregates, as the boss, or the controller, the observer, or the inhabitant of them. Even if we have not studied such non-Buddhist theories in this lifetime, based on study in previous lives, the self would appear to us as if it existed that way, and it would feel like that. And when you think about it, doesn't it seem as though the speaker of the voice in our heads is a me that is separate from our bodies and minds? However, this is like an illusion in the sense that the self does not exist in the way that it appears to exist. Yet despite being like an illusion, the conventional self functions. It can eat. I can experience suffering. And I can gain liberation from suffering. So once we have eliminated this impossible manner of existence to be nullified or refuted, we need to identify what is left in its place. In this case, we're left with a self that is not unaffected by things, but is affected by them, and thus changes moment by moment, is not solid, but has facets or parts, and is not separate from the body and mind, but is mentally labeled or imputed upon them. Now, all of the tenet systems accept that a further nullification or refutation of a more subtle impossible way of existing is necessary. What now needs to be refuted is that such a self, again, an affected, constantly changing, non-solid entity imputed on the aggregates, exists as something that is self-sufficiently knowable, self-sufficient, substantially existent. This is because even after we have nullified the object to be refuted, the self still automatically appears to be self-sufficiently knowable. In other words, it appears to be something that can be known by itself, without a basis for its imputation being known simultaneously. So no one has to teach us that. For example, we want someone to love me. Not simply to love me for my body, my intelligence, or my money. Such a me, we imagine, could be cognized with love all by itself, without a body, a mind, or possessions, also being cognized with love at the same time. It automatically feels as though there is such a me, although this is like an illusion. Alex goes on to say that we automatically feel that there is a me that can be known self-sufficiently, even when we also imagine that this me exists as an unaffected solid entity separate from the body and mind, controlling them as their inhabitant and boss. And such a me, of course, is like an illusion. Much more subtle and difficult to realize, however, is an affected, constantly changing, non-solid me, imputable on a body and mind, also cannot be known on its own. So once we have refuted and eliminated this subtler impossible manner of existence, we realize the conventional me can only be imputedly known. So now we're left with a conventionally existent self, a me, which is an affected, constantly changing, validly knowable phenomenon, imputable on a body and mind, but which cannot be cognized without some facet of its basis for imputation also being simultaneously cognized. However, it still feels as though such a me is truly findably existent or inherently existent. In other words, it feels as though there is some findable characteristic feature on the side of such an imputably knowable me that by its own power makes this person truly and uniquely me and not someone else. It feels as though there must be something findable that allows for a correct labeling of this individual stream of continuity of aggregates as me. And all tenet systems accept such an inherently existent me, except for Prasangika. Prasangika asserts that this mode of existence is also impossible, and that such a me is also like an illusion. Once this impossible mode of existence is nullified, we are left with a conventional me that merely arises dependently in terms of mental labeling. It is merely what the label me refers to when labeled on the basis of an ever-changing individual stream of continuity of five aggregates. In other words, the conventional me is merely an affected, constantly changing, non-monolithic phenomenon imputable on an individual continuum of aggregates. It cannot exist separately from those aggregates. It is not a boss, controller, or inhabitant of those aggregates, and it cannot be known on its own, separately from those aggregates. And moreover, its existence is not established by some inherently findable characteristic features on the side of the aggregates that allow the me to be correctly labeled or imputed on those aggregates. Rather, the me is established or proved as something conventionally existent merely by the fact that it is validly imputable on the aggregates. So like an illusion, the self appears to exist in a manner other than that. Nevertheless, despite its deceptive appearance, and despite its being devoid of the impossible manner of existence that it appears to have, I still function. So now we'll move to phenomena existing like an illusion. Alex says that even before we understand the Prasangika position regarding how the self is like an illusion, if we can understand the non-Prasangika view of this, we can start to apply the analogy of an illusion to other phenomena as well. And this is important because the self does not exist in isolation from other phenomena. The self experiences phenomena. It is affected by ignorance or unawareness, and then experiences deceptive appearances of the phenomena of samsara. It can also be affected by discriminating awareness or understanding, and then the self can experience liberation. Therefore, it's very important to understand how phenomena exist. Although except for Prasangika, the various tenet systems do not assert as a true cause of samsara an awareness about how phenomena exist, but nevertheless, samsaric beings still have an awareness and confusion about it. So have we seen, when focusing on the self, which is imputed on the aggregates need to appear to the consciousness. So although the main focus for gaining liberation is on ridding ourselves of the ignorance concerning how the I exists, if we have confusion about the appearance of the aggregates that must appear when focusing on me, that confusion will cause problems. For this reason, then, we must also gain a correct understanding of the two truths concerning all phenomena that might appear among the aggregate factors of each moment of our experience. This is the case even in the fundamental systems, which do not assert avoidness of all phenomena. If we understand that the aggregates that appear simultaneously when we cognize me are like an illusion, we might still think that there is a solid me, existing and knowable separately from these aggregates that are appearing. This could happen if we have not already understood that the self is like an illusion. So Alex says we need to understand the voidness of the self first before we go too strongly into deconstructing the deceptive appearances of phenomena. On the other hand, once we have an initial understanding that the self is like an illusion, devoid of impossible ways of existing, our understanding of the aggregates also to be alike an illusion reinforces our understanding regarding the self. As Alex says, if the basis for labeling something is not solid, but is like an illusion, how can something labeled on it be solid? It too must be alike an illusion. So one way to approach the understanding of the illusion-like aspects of phenomena is through the stages indicated by the progressively more subtle assertions of the Indian Buddhist schools of tenets. And although this approach is not found traditionally, Alex suggests that we could follow the same structure as previously when we were looking at the self regarding the illusion-like aspects. With this approach, we would narrow in on an increasingly more sophisticated understanding of the illusion-like aspects of phenomena through the refutation and nullification of increasingly more refined and possible modes of existence. So this approach is based on the assertions of the two truths, conventional and ultimate, in each tenet system. In the fundamental systems, the two truths are two sets of true phenomena. Although superficial or conventional true phenomena conceal deepest true phenomena, the superficial phenomena are not traditionally regarded to be like an illusion in the two fundamental schools. In the Mahayana system, on the other hand, the two truths are two facts about every phenomenon. And since the superficial truth about something conceals its deepest truth, superficial truths are considered to be like an illusion. So in order to make a system of analysis that spans the fundamental schools and Mahayana, the untraditional approach suggested here looks in a Mahayana way at the two truths in the fundamental schools. In other words, it looks at the two true phenomena asserted in the fundamental schools as if they were two truths about one phenomena, the aggregates, and aims to give the insight that all levels of superficial truth about the aggregates are like an illusion. So we'll begin with the Vibhashika system. The five aggregates, form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness, refer to the changing factors that comprise each moment of our daily experience. They consist of forms of physical phenomena, ways of being aware of things, and certain functional abstractions imputable on them, such as impermanence. Forms of physical phenomena that we experience, such as objects that we see or feel, appear to be solid. This is like an illusion. However, because they are actually a collection of tiny particles, their appearance as a solid entity is only their superficial or conventional truth. Their deepest or ultimate truth is the collection of particles that comprise them. Although Vibhashika does not assert that the conventional truth about something is like an illusion, since it is a fundamental school, nevertheless, we can apply this analogy to help us overcome suffering. For example, when we see a scratch mark on a car and become upset or angry, we can deconstruct the car and the scratch mark into its component atoms. What then is the object of our anger? The solidity of the car and of the scratch mark is like an illusion. On the deepest level, the car and the scratch mark are just collections of atoms. Are we angry with the atoms? Or another example would be when we feel a pain in our back, are the atoms of our back causing us the pain? If we can train ourselves that when the appearing object for focusing on me is seeing a collection of atoms, then the anger in the moment is lessened because it becomes easier to understand the lack of that me existing as a solid soul. Similarly, speech that we hear is made up of the sounds of individual syllables. The sound of each syllable that we hear exists for just a moment and then no longer exists. So the sound of the entire sentence existing all at once as a solid entity is like an illusion. Only the sound of one syllable at a time actually exists. When we hear a sentence of insult directed toward us, which syllable of it is the object causing us anger? So the first important insight from Vibhashika regarding the phenomena that we experience in samsara is that they are made of tiny parts. The second concerns impermanence. Situations that we encounter, whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, appear to be permanent in the sense of being static, unchanging. It's as if we enter a situation, take a photograph of it, and then the picture of that frozen moment captured in the still photo is the actual situation. This is like an illusion. No situation exists in the impossible manner of a still photograph. Understanding this helps us to overcome suffering. Take the example of feeling hurt because of being rejected by someone. We can understand this illusion on two levels. The first is the illusion that the situation will last forever in the manner that appears in the still photo. When we refute that, we are still left with the still photo and merely the understanding that sometime in the future the situation will end. Until then, however, it seems as though the situation will remain basically the same. This too is like an illusion. Each moment the situation is changing and drawing closer to its end. This is its subtle impermanence. Furthermore, the circumstance that indicates the final end of the situation, such as meeting someone else, appears to be the cause of the ending of the situation of feeling hurt. This, however, is also like an illusion. The actual cause for the end of the situation of feeling hurt is the fact that the situation arose in the first place. And its arising is due to many, many causes. So now we move on to Sautrantika. Once we can deconstruct the appearance of what we experience in terms of the illusion that it is solid, will last forever, does not change from moment to moment, the Sautrantika insight helps us to go further. Why do the illusion-like phenomena we experience cause us problems? Not everyone has problems with the same objects or situations, so it must have something to do with the mind. The superficial truth about these objects is the projections that we cast on them. For example, we project onto the scratch mark the image of it being a disaster, the worst thing in the world that happened to our car. This mode of existing, however, is like an illusion. The deepest truth is just the objective reality of the object. It is just a scratch mark made of a collection of atoms, and it is impermanent. The cause of the car becoming damaged was the fact that the car was manufactured. The other car bumping into it was just the circumstance of the damage appearing. The Sautrantika insight to separate projections from objective reality, then, draws us closer to understanding the relation between our perception, our problems, and objective facts. So now we move on to Chittamatra. So the Vibhashika and Sautrantika insights concern the phenomena we experience, which are the basis for labeling me. I am experiencing them in five aggregates. Even with these insights about them, we still face the danger of blaming our problems on objective reality. With the Vibhashika understanding, we clear away our misconception that things are solid and permanent. With the Sautrantika understanding, we go further and clear away all other projections. However, we are still left with objective reality, sitting out there, waiting for us to come along so that it can cause us problems. Even if we understand that our karma causes us to encounter these phenomena of objective reality, we may still feel that objectively real phenomena are the cause of problems. So Chittamatra helps us to turn our focus to our own minds and the confusion that flows with it as the causes of our problems. So it is like an illusion that the objects we encounter are sitting out there, around the corner, waiting for us to come along to cognize them. Alex says we have to understand that we actually perceive cognitive appearances. The Vibhashika and Sautrantika presentations prepare the way for understanding this. According to Vibhashika, we see external objects directly, not through any cognitive appearance. According to Sautrantika, we see external objects through transparent cognitive appearances, which are cognitive representations of the objects. Chittamatra emphasizes the fact that the cognitive appearances that we see and the sense consciousness that sees them both come from the same natal source, namely from the same seed of karmic potential on our mental continuums. In fact, all that we see are cognitive appearances, and they are like illusion, in that they appear to arise from actual, objectively existing objects out there, waiting to give us pleasure or pain. However, they do not exist in that impossible way. The onus or blame for all the appearances that we experience lies on our own individual and shared karma. We cannot blame our suffering on external situations or on other persons. Although the appearance of external objective reality is like an illusion, nevertheless, the illusion-like sense objects we cognize do function. And we know they function because moments of experiencing results arise from them, such as eating and then feeling full. Cause and effect still work, though like an illusion. So now we move on to the Svatantrika Madhyamaka. So the Chittamatra view helps us to understand that the mode of appearance of the sense objects that we experience is not established from the side of the objects, but from the side of the mind that cognizes them. So the appearances of sense objects that we cognize are established from the mind. This is the case even after we have cleared away false notions that these appearances are solid and that they are permanent, and after we have cleared also away all the other conceptual projections as well. So there is no excuse for blaming our problems on something or someone out there. Chittamatra, however, asserts that only the sense objects we experience are like illusions. It is like the example of realizing that a movie is like an illusion, but insisting that the projector of the movie must be real in order to project it. So Chittamatra does not apply the analogy of an illusion to the consciousness that sees sense objects, although that consciousness may seem to be partless and to have projected identities, such as being so smart or so bad. So with just the Chittamatra understanding, we still can be attached to our minds or be angry with them. So we need to go deeper to understand that not only the mode of appearance of objects, but the mode of existence of objects is established by the mind. Moreover, we need to understand this in relation not only to sense objects, but also to the consciousness that perceives them and to all other phenomena as well. So this brings us to the insight of mental labeling or imputation. All systems other than Prasangika assert that the existence of all phenomena is established by their own individual defining characteristics on their own sides, and which are not merely imputable there. Svatantrika agrees that there is something on the side of validly knowing, knowable phenomena that establishes their existence. However, these findable defining characteristics cannot establish the existence of validly knowable phenomena by their own power alone. It may appear as though these findable characteristics on the side of phenomena establish the existence of the phenomena by themselves, but this appearance is like an illusion. It is only the fact that validly knowable phenomena can be validly labeled or imputed on the basis of these findable characteristics that establishes the existence of validly knowable phenomena. So here's an example. If we think that a dog is a cat and then we label it cat, does that make the dog into a cat? Svatantrika explains that it is only because certain animals possessing the defining characteristics of a cat findable somewhere in them on their own sides that these animals can serve as valid bases for labeling them cat. Otherwise, the labeling of anything as anything could be valid. But because a dog does not possess the findable defining characteristics of a cat, labeling it a cat is not valid mental labeling. So with the Svatantrika insight, we understand that a combination of external and internal factors establishes the existence of phenomena. This insight allows the analogy of being like an illusion to apply to all phenomena, both permanent and impermanent, not just to sense objects. So now we go to Prasangika Madhyamaka. With the Vibhashika understanding, we have deconstructed the illusion-like appearance of sense objects and consciousness being solid and permanent. With the Sautrantika understanding, we have cleared out other projections from them as well. Further, with the Chittamatra understanding, we have cleared out the misconception that the appearances of sense objects are established from their own sides. They are established by the karmic potentials of the minds that cognize them. With the Svatrantika understanding, we have cleared out the further misconception that the existence of any validly knowable phenomena is established exclusively from its own side. The existence of any validly knowable phenomena is established through a combination of something findable on its own side and mental labeling. Now, according to Prasangika, however, although all phenomena appear to have findable characteristic features on their own sides that establish their existence as this or that, in conjunction with them being labeled this or that, this is like an illusion. If there were such findable features, they could lead to attachment and grasping to them. We could still place the blame for our problems on external objects or on a me. For example, there must be something inherently wrong in me, making me no good. The true cause of our problems, however, is the mind's making deceptive appearances of impossible modes of existence and the unawareness and grasping that come from that. Because the deceptive appearances of impossible modes of existence are produced by the mind needs to stop projecting them. If the existence of objects as this or that were established by something from the side of the objects, even in conjunction with mental labeling, this could shift the focus of attention away from the mind's confusion as the source of our problems. It could shift it to analyzing only externally to find the inherent characteristic features of objects that make the objects what they are so that we can mentally label them correctly. Therefore, we need to understand existence established by mental labeling alone. So we can see how in our own lives, how we keep continually over and over again projecting outward and seeing that the problem is something external to us that is so deeply ingrained, at least in my mind. And not only that, but I forget. I know this, I read this, I understand it to a little degree, and then I promptly forget it over and over again. So that just is, to me, an indication of how deeply held these misconceptions are. Alex says that the existence of any phenomena, according to Prasangika, is established merely by the fact that it can be validly imputed or labeled on a basis for imputation or basis for labeling. What the label refers to cannot be found on the side of the basis for imputation. Not even the defining characteristic features of what the label refers to can be found there. What establishes that the labeling of the phenomena is a valid labeling, consequently, what establishes that the phenomena that the label refers to is an existent phenomenon that is validly knowable, are merely criteria from the side of the mind. So there's three criteria. The first one is the label needs to be a well-known convention, something that we all agree on. The label needs not to be contradicted by a mind that validly cognizes the conventional truth of the phenomena. And the label needs not to be contradicted by a mind that validly cognizes the deepest or ultimate truth of the phenomena. So Alex concluded that the Indian Buddhist tenet systems present graded levels of understanding, not only of how things exist like an illusion, but also of how cognition works. When studying these systems, it's important to avoid thinking that they're merely dry theories. They provide essential material for meditation to gain ever deeper understandings. And the purpose for gaining these understanding is not for acquiring intellectual knowledge, not to become, you know, really wise debaters. It's for applying them to everyday life in order to overcome our individual problems, our suffering, and to enable us to help others most effectively by bringing us to enlightenment. So in the last teaching, Venerable talked about the period between meditation sessions. She said that what we do between sessions strongly influences our meditation. And in the text, Nam Kapel writes, in the period between sessions, be a creator of illusions. And he goes on to write, there are two ways to take the analogy of illusions, that thing appear like illusions or that they really are illusions. And so if we say that it is an illusion, we are saying that nothing is there. So we have to be careful about our language and how we think about these things. However, saying things appear like an illusion, then after the meditation on emptiness, we perceive that things appear inherently existent, but our mental consciousness remembers that they exist differently. It is a dependent existence. We then train our minds to remember things exist differently than they appear. So, that was Alex's teaching. I hope it was a little helpful. So we'll dedicate.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west. Whoa.